personal relationship involved that went beyond?
Not that I know of, but I wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that close to Kennedy's social affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wouldn't be so sure about Dylan being conservative. He was, as a Republican, he was filled a political need of the new president, but I don't. But I think he was a rather liberal Republican, or at least a moderate Republican.
So he was more in the Rockefeller mold of New York Republican.
Yeah, the old public service mode of the elite or aristocratic lawyers and businessmen who were both Republicans and Democrats.
So did you see a sharp difference between him on the issue of balancing the budget on an annual basis and on government deficits causing inflation? Was there a sharp difference between him and Anderson and Humphrey, who preceded him? Were they different on those issues, more liberal, or were they?
Yeah, I think Dylan was more pragmatic about that, and he was perhaps not as concerned about the balance of the budget as initially Kennedy was. But Kennedy didn't have any economic reason for that. He was only worried about being severely criticized by the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere for fiscal imprudence.
And the story is that his father was very concerned about gold, and whenever he saw the sun, he lectured the sun, and that was an influence. Did you hear that?
Yes, indeed. I don't know that from firsthand, but we certainly heard a lot about it. Well, sometimes, rather frequently, Kennedy would call us up and say that his father said this and that, and his father's worried about this or that. Or he'd say, people are worried, and we would interpret that to mean that it was his father. And so then we would try to reassure him or give him the other side of the picture.
Mm-hmm. During this period, you basically assumed that there could be no change in international monetary arrangements, no revaluation of other currencies. There was some in 61, but it was a very limited revaluation of the...
Standard was a sacred thing, and the value of the dollar was thought to be so immutable and so important to have it be immutable that one wasn't even supposed to talk about the question, no matter what you said. And the Treasury wanted to assume that we were always going to have the $35 gold price. And they thought that the confidence of the world in the dollar depended on that being something that was not even on the table, even for academic discussion. I think Dylan was believed that, all that, but he was greatly influenced by Rosa, and Rosa was very strong and self-assured on questions like that.
So was it somewhat, did Rosa have the relationship with Dylan that Volcker had later with David Kennedy, the conservative Fed view of the time, and like David Kennedy really let Volcker take the lead in...
That was after my time in Washington. I don't know about Volcker and David Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
You mean Rosa was undersecretary.
Right.
And he had been appointed from
he had been at the New York Fed.
The New York Fed. And I don't know that he and Dylan were friends before or well acquainted at all before he came, but Rosa was, a, he he wrote, there was a PhD in economics. He's from Harvard. I was my contemporary and friend. But we disagreed terribly on this whole matter. I like Rosa, but I think he was a very good economist, actually. Certainly on this point.
He had the demeanor of an Ivy League intellectual, but on the issue of the deficit and international monetary arrangements, he was very much of a sort of conservative Republican businessman, wasn't he?
Wall Street view. More so. I don't think he cared so much about the deficit per se, but he thought everything was in terms of what its effect would be on the opinion of the financial markets about the dollar.
Another factor must have also been the sort of perpetual recurrence of international crises. Kennedy's feeling that he did not want a gold crisis on top of all the international problems he was having.
Well, I don't know about that so much. He was very much worried about the possibility that he would do something to the dollar when he first came into office, and then the Republicans and Wall Streeters would say, see, every time the Democrats come in, they fiddle with the money. So he wanted to be very sound on money and the dollar. Just for that reason, he didn't want this political fallout from it. Kennedy also had a simplistic view of what the gold problem was. And when he read about balance of payments deficits, he translated those into gold losses, dollar for dollar. And so that's why he initiated things like a gold budget and to the departments required to keep track of not just what they're spending in dollars, but what it translated into gold losses. And gold losses, in his view, were equivalent to balance of payments deficits. So we explained to him successfully. He's a smart guy, Jack Kennedy. I worked on this, and Kermit Gordon worked on this, and Walter Heller did, but it was my bailiwick particularly to work on this, is to convince the president that no, and this is Kermit Gordon's idea, that no, convince him that no gold leaves the country except by a political decision of a foreign government. And notably in those years, that was de Gaulle. Mm-hmm. And after he understood that, he was personally a good bit more relaxed about gold. Then he understood the situation. I could tell you that in 1961, we at the council engaged my colleague at Yale, Robert Triffin, who is a leading authority on international money. Mm-hmm. And who was the originator of the Triffin dilemma, namely, if you gold when gold becomes a smaller part of U.S. Portfolio, of government portfolio, then there will be less desire to hold dollars. So he thought that was the sort of paradox and dilemma of the gold dollar standard.
The balance of payments is a line operation responsibility of the Treasury. Did they, in general, exclude you from discussions of...
Well, they often did, and they tried to, but we did have considerable discussions with them, especially when there were meetings with the president, in which the so-called quadriad, triad, that's not the word.
Well, the quadriad.
The quadriad included the Fed. It was the Treasury, the Budget Bureau, and the Council.
Right.
We talked to the president about economic policy.
Mm-hmm.
And that often included a discussion of the balance of payments problem and the gold and so on. And Dylan was, and Rosa in particular, were very jealous about keeping that as a treasury responsibility, and they would keep us out of it as much as they could.
Two of the major innovations of this period, Operation Twist and the beginning of foreign exchange intervention, establishment of swap lines with foreign central banks and so on, those must have been Rose's ideas, but did he include the council in the discussion of the, you know, in
well, the twist was not his idea, and he didn't like it.
Operation Twist?
That's right. He didn't favor it at all. Okay. That was our idea. That was my idea.
Okay, that's important, because I just assumed that with, you know, when you hear about Rosa, he talks about establishing these outer lines of defense for the dollar. And
well, he,
I just assumed that this was
he was not wanting to do anything about Twist at all from his point of view.
Hmm.
So when it was eventually decided to try to do something, and Martin agreed to try.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Martin didn't try very hard,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Rose's view was that if he made transactions like that would cause such a lack of confidence, it would be counterproductive. It's a famous memo that he sent us to the council, which told us that if they did Operation Twist seriously, it would have exactly the opposite results from what we wanted.
Hmm. That's interesting, because this is just sort of later and anecdotal, but I have a friend at the New York Fed who wrote up the history of this period for one of their publications, and she had a comment in there that it was controversial about whether Operation Twist actually had any effect on the term structure. And she got a call from Bob Rosa. This is obviously while he was still alive, and he was very critical. He said, "Oh yeah, it was very important. It really did have an effect."
He might have changed his mind, but
he must have become a convert. Later, he must have become a convert to it.
Yes, but he often, from our point of view, he often did Operation Twist at least appeared to be doing Operation Twist, but then he was engaged in anticipatory conversions of short-term assets into long. So he actually wasn't selling in shorts. He was or buying them. He was making it easy for holders to convert them before they came due.
So he had the conventional Treasury view on the desirability of lengthening the term structure of interest rates.
Yes.
That was just
so
straight.
At the same time that he was, we wanted him to be buying, reducing the supply outstanding of longs.
Mm-hmm.
And but then he was offering longs to in these anticipatory maturations of other debt.
Hmm.
So it's sort of, but then Rosa is, what Rosa is mainly responsible for is putting a tariff on the bond issues.
The interest equalization tax.
Interest equalization tax. Today, that would be considered a terrible intervention into the markets, wouldn't it?
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Capital controls, it seemed like there was a change in attitude between the Heller and the Ackley councils that may have reflected President Johnson's points of view. It seems like capital controls became more acceptable as you went on. Of course, the problem of balance of payments became perhaps more difficult. But was there a different intellectual attitude toward capital controls in general and between the Heller and the Ackley councils? I mean, did you have somewhat aversion to getting into all the bureaucracy that would be involved in that?
Well, I don't think I was not there during the Ackley Council.
Sure.
I left before the Heller.
Right.
Before Heller did, before the end of the Kennedy term. I'm not aware of that difference. It could be. But the argument that I was making to the president was that all the things that they were willing to do, like favoritism toward American suppliers of things that were purchased by AID.
Right.
So we had tied aid, that was to save gold.
Right, and American soldiers in Germany had to import their beer from America. I remember there were things like that.
Yeah, there were things like that. They were terrible things. So I tell the president that the whole point of the international monetary system was to have easy, free trade in the commodities without controls. And the reason the gold standard was thought to be desirable was that it facilitated that, and that was its purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And if you saved the appearance of the gold standard while having all these interventions and controls, then it didn't make any sense at all. It was the throwing not the baby out of the bath, but the mother.
Yeah. So there was no sympathy with Galbraith's general ideas that you ought to have combined easy money and controls. That was just not sort of policy that was considered.
Well, that's a Galbraith policy for the war, for war mobilization. That was not Galbraith's policy in the 60s. Galbraith was on the side of the Treasury.
Okay,
and
I didn't know this.
In the debates in the White House, in the Quadriat what do they call the three of us together?
Well, triad, I think.
Triad, that's not to sound right. Anyway, Galbraith sided with Dillon.
That seems hard to believe. I mean,
against us.
I would have thought he would be sort of whatever the left-wing position is.
He wasn't. He was the ambassador to Britain, to India. And he was worried about the American position in the Cold War, and he thought that the currency problem was a terrible obstacle to our success in the Cold War, and so he didn't want to do anything which endangered the gold standard.
Hmm. So his considerations were more foreign policy than...
Foreign policy considerations, yeah.
Hmm. One more footnote on something we just mentioned. You mentioned Martin's attitude toward Operation Twist. Did he have the same sort of attitude toward foreign exchange intervention? Is that something he went along with because the Treasury wanted, but he really needed to be sort of pushed into it? Or you may not know.
I don't know. I don't recall any... hearing Martin talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean he didn't, but not in my presence.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you some questions about Martin. In the Quadriad meetings, your contact with Martin, do you feel like he had a sense, at least a grasp of the economic issues, that he could think understand the arguments of economists, or did you view him primarily as a conservative banker?
Well, I don't know about how conservative, but he didn't talk economics when we talked. Mm-hmm. I was not present with him when he talked to the president. I don't think that that there were many times when there was a sort of full meeting of the council and the treasury and the budget bureau and Martin with the president. The president sometimes met with Martin by himself, sometimes I think with Dylan and maybe Heller sometimes. I wasn't there. But Martin was very intuitive and impressionistic about his attitude toward monetary policy, and there wasn't a lot of economics involved in it. It was his sense of the market and the financial markets and confidence and things like that. And
so in that sense, he was like Rosa. Although Rosa,
well,
of course, was more sophisticated.
So Rosa should have had the economic arguments, all right.
Yeah.
And of course, Martin had all the economists he wanted to talk to in the staff of the Fed. And the Fed chairman does have this tendency to think of what he's doing as a psychological game with markets rather than.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than economics, not just Martin, but right. He's extreme in that particular attitude.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to change. When in discussions of monetary policy, did you see?
I used to meet with Fed people once a week, and Martin and Helen and I had lunch with Martin. And usually once a week. We didn't have lunch with Martin when Dylan had lunch with Martin, which was also at least once a week.
On issues of monetary policy and interest rate policy, did you see a difference between the Fed and the Treasury? Did you think of the two of them as basically having the same attitude, or did you see them on a gamut where the Fed...
Well, it was sort of mixed. Sometimes Rosa was trying to get the Fed to do what we wanted the Fed to do. Sometimes Rosa said he was doing that and probably wasn't. And sometimes Rosa and Dylan were strengthening the Fed's resolve not to do what we wanted him to do.
So there's no easy generalization. You don't see the Treasury as restraining the Martin's desire to raise interest rates to deal with balance of payments problems. You don't see him as exercising a restraining influence on the Fed necessarily.
No. I think that he didn't want them to raise interest rates, and I think that. They didn't do is lower interest rates. And so we wanted lower short-term interest rates in 1962, and the Treasury's argument was that, Martin's argument was that they couldn't have lower interest rates because gold would flow out. So he didn't raise them, but he didn't lower them either. That's why Twist was suggested.
So Twist came after that.
But we still wanted to. That was the point of Twist, to get lower long-term rates.
So you did, at least in 62, sort of late spring, early summer, when you were concerned about recession, you did urge the Fed to consider lower interest rates. You weren't happy just to assume that fiscal policy and Operation Twist would take care of a lack of aggregate demand?
We weren't what?
You weren't willing to rely solely on fiscal policy and whatever effect on the term structure that you might have by debt operations. You weren't willing to rely on solely on those as far as aggregate demand went. You thought the Fed should have pushed rates down in 62 when it in fact raised them.
Well, yes, that, or at least we didn't want them to raise them.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. But we were looking for anything we could get.
Mm-hmm. And the Treasury wasn't necessarily supportive of that. The Treasury had its own concerns with balance of payments, so it didn't necessarily. The reason.
The Treasury's view is that on fiscal policy too, that more expansionary fiscal policy would be a good idea if it was done the way the Treasury wanted it to be done.
But that was with tax reform, right? And
yeah.
Tax reform was that was a whole political, you know, process
yes,
in itself.
If the Treasury does it, then it won't destroy confidence. If you guys do it, it will.
So the, one of the reasons you finally got moving on a tax cut was because Mills and Dillon got together and said, yeah, you know, we need tax reform and we're willing to get the lubrication that comes from a tax cut. Was that sort of changes the subject?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that way, and I don't know how much Mills and Dillon were together as opposed to Mills just talking to the group including Dillon and the president and Hiller. Mills himself was more comfortable with a tax reduction, which was disguised as a reform, an incentive, what would have called later a supply-side reform.
Mm-hmm.
So that just made him happier about having a expansionary fiscal policy tax cut.
So he was not conservative in the way that, say, Senator Byrd from Virginia was.
No.
He was more of a pragmatic individual.
But he didn't understand Keynesian economics, but he did understand that in a general way, that lowering taxes should improve economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some confused mixture there between income and substitution effects. I don't know when he tried to explain exactly what it was, but he didn't like a completely demand-motivated tax cut. Or at least one that said it was demand motivated.
Mm-hmm. So it was partly a question of packaging for him.
Packaging for him, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Cover so he wouldn't look.
And as far as, I mean, Dillon understood we needed demand, so he wasn't against the demand motivated tax cut. He just thought if we do it my way, with my tax reforms at the same time, then it will be okay in the financial markets.
Oh, I see. So it's the confidence thing again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, what they extracted from Kennedy was that he would submit a balanced budget in the next budget.
Yeah, that was at the mid 61 with the Berlin crisis and the issue of whether they were going to.
No, it was a year later than that.
So even a year later, the Treasury was still pushing for a balanced budget.
Yes.
Fiscal 63.
Yes.
Hmm.
And that's what they agreed to submit the tax legislation at the same time if the president agreed to a balanced budget at that time.
Hmm. Let me come back to Martin and his attitudes again. There was a debate at this time over whether 6% unemployment represented structural unemployment or whether it was a lack of aggregate demand, and Martin was on the sort of burn structural side. Do you think Martin's failure to raise interest rates more aggressively was because he really was concerned about domestic economy and unemployment, or was it more the restraining influence of the CEA and the Treasury?
Well, I think it was more of the latter.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Martin became content with the idea that, well, these guys aren't such wild-eyed radicals as I thought they were, and if they're going to be satisfied just to keep interest rates where they are, well, I won't feel so bad.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play squash with Martin.
Oh.
That's a good friend of his.
He was very...
nice guy.
He was very athletic. You must have been a good squash player.
Yeah.
Good. Let's see. Just moving on a little bit. Was there, and this was after you left the council, so you may not know, but was there a fear that Martin might thwart the tax reduction with a rate hike? Was that a real fear, or was that not really something Martin was likely to do?
That wasn't something Martin was likely to do, and as long as he was included in the discussions with the president about the general stance of policy, I think he was willing to go along.
Mm-hmm. This is sort of completely out of the blue, but it's something that happened at this time. Do you know how Mitchell was chosen as a governor? Were you involved in that selection process at all, George Mitchell?
Mm-hmm. Some different governors and maybe some more economics into the Open Market Committee, and we needed somebody who would be okay in Congress and wouldn't be too offensive to Martin. And Mitchell was the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Seemed to be the ideal guy for that, and he was.
Was Seymour Harris considered at this time or later?
Seymour Harris considered for the Board of Governors?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
Okay. And this came after your time, so you don't necessarily know the answer, but the guideposts. I guess the guideposts were...
Guideposts came in the...
In the 62 economic report.
In the economic report of 1962.
Yeah. Why, if the unemployment rate was so high, the output gap negative, why the need for guideposts? Why did the council put those in the economic report of the president at that time?
Well, the anticipation was that we'd have wage pressures before we got to what we regarded as full employment.
Mm-hmm. So you were looking ahead to the time when the unemployment rate would come down from upper 5% range
to
4%.
It would just be moving in the direction which would cause people to give workers, unions, more power, and we're trying to avoid what we regarded as premature wage pressures and price pressures.
Did you see 4% unemployment as being accompanied by 2% inflation, some positive inflation rate that was made the guideposts necessary?
Well, there could be some probability, some non-zero probability that would be true.
Mm-hmm.
And the 4% looked like a point of view of what actually was full capacity production, it looked like a good guess as to what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that there shouldn't be sort of market related inflationary pressures, increasing inflationary pressures at 4%. But we did have these big unions and big businesses. And we had worked on the steel wage settlement in 1961 because even though we were far, far from full employment or full capacity production of steel, the contract was coming up for grabs, and we were afraid that there was going to be a increase in steel wages and steel prices as a result. And we got Goldberg, the Secretary of Labor, who used to be the counsel of the Steel Workers Union, to work and knew also the business side of the industry, to work on trying to get a bargain where the union would hold down the wage increases in 61. The union would hold down the wage increase if the to a non-inflationary level, and if the managements agreed that they wouldn't raise prices at the same time. That's when the U.S. Steel president reneged and came and told the president he was raising the prices on the very day.
And he just thought he could get away with it.
What?
He just thought he did it because he just thought he could get away with it.
He thought he could, but he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you more general. Well, I'm also curious, the one of the important aspects of policy innovations at the time was to make explicit the level of the output gap. And that was reported in the Economic Report of the President, you know, for many years. Were you involved in that, in the discussions of how to choose the base year and draw the trend line, or was that pretty much a consensus thing? You know, it wasn't something that involved a lot of sort of need for debate.
And that was one of our major items in the Council in 1961 right away, as we observed this demand versus structural debate, and what Martin was saying, and a lot of other people were also saying that it was structural unemployment, and that, so we were already at full employment, even with 7% unemployment, and so we thought that was a terrible attitude, which was undermining our policy. And also, the president said, and Ted Sorensen said, that they didn't understand what we were up, what we were excited about, because he said when he went to college, 96% was A, and 93% was A minus. And so why should he spend a lot of political capital to raise his grade from A minus? That's 96% employment for 7% unemployment, from 93% to 96%, which would be an A. He had other things to use his political capital on. Of course, we knew that there was a lot more change in the overall economic situation, such employment and production were related, et cetera, et cetera. So what I did was to, we knew that was true. We wanted to quantify it so we could tell the president what was involved. And so that's when I called up Art Oakland, who was still up here at Yale, and asked him to do the empirical research to give a quantitative estimate of that, which became Oakland's Law. And so we were very active. And meanwhile, Bob Solo was getting the guy up at MIT, his name I've forgotten this moment, to show that there wasn't any evidence of structural unemployment in the distribution of unemployment across different groups in the labor market. So we put on a big campaign, a big sort of political economy campaign on this whole point, which changed change the way people look at
so
between cycles and growth, I think, for all time.
So you had to first persuade Kennedy, though, and he signed on to the 4% unemployment goal that was in the economic report of the president.
Not only signed on to it, he signed a report which said it.
Mm-hmm.
The only president ever did specify and accept a numerical target for unemployment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was very important. Do you feel like at the time you must have been, you know, sort of, you know, you were involved in doing intellectual combat with the conservative Washington establishment that wanted to balance the budget every year and viewed deficits per se as inflationary. But I mean, you really won the intellectual battle, wouldn't you say, on that issue, because of getting Kennedy to sign on to the 4% unemployment target, and because of making the output gap explicit.
I had to agree to advocate a demand increasing tax cut, even though we were not in a recession.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we weren't where we were supposed to be in terms of our macro target. That was the big innovation.
When you go back and you read this period, about this period, it's amazing how many international crises there were. You know, Bay of Pigs, Berlin Wall, Cuban Missile Crisis, Diem in Vietnam. Did you feel like it was hard to get Kennedy's attention on economic issues because he was distracted with these world, first-class world...
Well, it was when there was a crisis going on, but it wasn't hard to get his attention otherwise.
Because he felt it was important, and he was
important, and he liked it,
and he was interested. He was a person who liked ideas, and you could.
He liked ideas, and he liked to talk to professors.
Well, that makes him pretty extraordinary as a politician. I'm sure it was a special time for you. Do you have anything? I don't want to take too much of your time. Do you have anything else about this period that you feel like I ought to understand? I've run through my questions.
One little thing I might tell you is that there's a... during the period between the election and the inauguration, there was various task forces appointed by the president-elect, and he appointed a task force on... well, it wasn't called macroeconomic policy, but that was the general idea of it. And Paul Samuelson was the... chairman of it, Heller was on it, and I was on it, and some others. So Dillon, I guess, or somebody, prevailed on the president to appoint another task force, which had Rosa on it, and that was so just to offset the radical ideas that he anticipated to come out of the Samuelson.
Well, wasn't there also McCracken and Sproul and Blount, I guess? That was a very conservative group of people. Were they afraid that you were going to advocate revaluation of the Deutschmark or something?
I guess they thought we might do that or advocate a $10 billion deficit instead of a $2 billion one or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Kennedy really had to... kind of avoid the irresponsible spending label, I guess, feelings that, like, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, deficit spending.
But Samuelson is not a reckless guy.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to do that.
No. No. Well, that's very interesting.
Have you read memoirs?
Actually, I was able to get a copy of that, and I have.
Yeah, it's here at the Kennedy Library. Yeah.
Right. I have gotten a copy of that. If there's anything in there I want to quote from you, do I have permission to do that?
Sure.
Oh, super. Because that's great. Well.